Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 151, recorded January 5th, 2011, Budget Upgrades and CES.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. My name is Patrick Gordon, and we are excited here at Twitch. Why? Because we're all going to be traveling to the Consumer Electronics Show next week to see the latest and greatest in the consumer electronics. Ryan Shrout, when do you leave for the great gathering of new technology?
We all head out Saturday morning for an arrival Saturday afternoon in time for me to go find a sports bar to watch UK basketball and Cincinnati football play, and then probably be depressed later in the evening.
So. Which animal am I to cheer for when we're talking about the...
You should cheer for both Wildcats and Bengals. Related, familial, so that's, you know, it makes it easier.
Go Cats!
Yes, go exactly.
Cats. I will be arriving probably around midnight. I'm driving the truck full of equipment down to CES, so I will call you, and if you need a designated driver to bring your Kentucky sports supporting ass home, whatever terrible sports bar you found yourself in, probably surrounded by... If my friend's Vegas law holds true, he's like, every time I'm in a sports bar or like a sports book in Vegas, it's like me and 175 people that are rooting for the other team. And he's like, it's really cool because I always win the bet, but it's always really scary because they're going to beat me before I can get to the window for the payout.
Nobody else is angry but you, yes.
Yeah, it's just like, dude, you have issues. Twitch at twit.tv. Normally we talk about technology. We will be talking about computer hardware. Bunch of news this week. You can email us your questions. We'll be talking about those later in the show. Twitch at twit.tv. And we're going to start with something exciting. We haven't said to you in at least a week, this is the fastest graphics card ever. But hey, guess what? Chimino, world record 3D Mark 11 score on an HD 7970. This is ridiculous, right? 15,063 on 3D Mark 11, 54,725 on 3D Mark Vantage with an 84% overclock. And how did he do it? Liquid nitrogen. Scroll down a little bit, Chad. You can see the picture of the word Rube Goldberg comes to mind. My favorite substance in the world, blue tape. I'm pretty sure those are like Costco paper towels. You can see the top of that where you pour the liquid nitrogen. And somewhere inside of that is a Radeon HD 7970. And in case you're wondering in the studio audience why you would stuff half a roll of paper towels around a GPU sitting on top of a motherboard before pouring it full of liquid nitrogen, is condensation. So what Shimino and anybody else doing liquid nitrogen overclocking is doing is pouring the coldest substance that it's easy to buy at a local welding shop or anywhere else for most of us. Into that hopper at the top, liquid nitrogen boils off, cools the processor, and there's usually insane amounts of condensation and or condensation that immediately turns into frost. This will kill your computer's motherboard or your GPU. So basically what the dude's trying to do is keep the system living long enough to score his record. And he did. And that's going to hold for like at least a week because I think he's going to do he's going to set up two cards next week?
I think that's what they were talking about is doing that. Yeah. For reference, that score of 15,000 in 3D Mark 11, I believe, is right on par with what our 7970 Crossfire result is with kind of stock settings. So, you know, if you have a buddy who wants to do nothing but pour liquid nitrogen into your graphics cards while you play video games, you can get the performance of two 7970s for the cost of one and whatever LN2 costs.
Yeah, and given what liquid nitrogen costs, I'd say buy the second card, people, and save your...
You don't have to pay your friend to stand there either. There's a little bit of a convenience factor, too.
Some interesting stuff going up. PC Pro this week. Intel moves on to the server room with 40 processors due for release. It looks like, in some ways, Intel's, and I'm going to quote the title here again, giveth to the server room and taketh from the desktop. It seems like the low-end Ivy Bridge low-end Ivy Bridge CPUs are kind of disappearing from the lineup that we expected. But there is the awesome Intel Core i7-3820, a Sandy Bridge E under $300. Is it awesome, or am I overstating? Are you excited? Are you?
No, I'm here. I have the 3820 sitting here. You really can't tell. They look, all the Sandy Bridge E parts look the same. So what's interesting about this is, as the picture that he is showing you there, and I have these two parts as well, the Sandy Bridge E, this larger chip here, and the Sandy Bridge, these are both quad-core processors built on the same process, 32-nanometer process technology. You might say, gee, Ryan, those are very different size chips to both kind of have fairly similar levels of performance, and you'd be correct. Part of the difference is that this package also actually will hold the 8-core version of that processor or the 6-core version of that processor. So it's really just to make sure it fits in the same socket. But the 3820 Sandy Bridge E is actually a quad-core CPU. It's not a 6-core part like all the other Sandy Bridge E processors we have talked about. And so it's in this weird kind of in-between of the Sandy Bridge E processors and Sandy Bridge that we already know, like 2600K and the 2700K, right? So performance, pretty similar between them. The clock speeds are a little bit higher on the Sandy Bridge E part, but maybe like 100 megahertz, 200 megahertz, depending on what SKU you're actually going to compare it to. Performance is fairly even between them, but this Core i7-3820 actually costs a little bit less than the Core i7-2600K and about $80 less than the 2700K. What's unfortunate then about that is the motherboard prices kind of make up for that difference. You're going to pay a good $75 more for an X79 motherboard simply because these new Sandy Bridge G parts have 40 lanes of PCI Express. They have four channels of memory, so you can run 8 DIMMs or 4 DIMMs, up to 64 gigabytes of memory. So they have some other feature advantages over Sandy Bridge. But the platform cost is going to be a little bit more than you would get on normal Sandy Bridge. So I'm still kind of up in the air whether or not I think this part, when it actually is released, I believe in February, will be the kind of new Core i7-920, which I know you are a fan of. yes. So we'll have to see. I'm hopeful that it will be, not because it offers significant advantages over what's out there or it's going to have a longer lifespan. It won't necessarily be around any longer than the LGA 1155 socket processors. It overclocks pretty well. It's not an unlocked CPU, but we were able to overclock it through some of the new Sandy Bridge E overclocking features like the CPU strap, which basically allows you to move the bus speed, the base clock speed, up to 125 megahertz really easily. So the big advantages then are you get the PCI Express. You do not get integrated graphics, right? So keep in mind that even, you know, you can buy Sandy Bridge quad-core parts like this that have integrated graphics. You get to take advantage of QuickSync technology, which, depending on if you actually use software that takes advantage of that, you will not get that with the more expensive platform in Sandy Bridge G or the bigger/newer processor in Sandy Bridge G. So it's a little kind of a give and take there. If somebody came to me and said they don't see the benefit of 3820 and they were just going to stick with the 2600K, I would have no argument against that necessarily. But if somebody said they really loved the 3820 and they were going to do multi-GPU gaming and they wanted to make sure they had all the PCIe lanes that were PCIe 3.0 capable and ready for the future and that type of stuff, and they were willing to spend the $60 or $75 more to get that, I would say that's a good investment too. So it's hard for me to pick one or the other. If I were building a system, I'd probably build it around Sandy Bridge E because I like PCI Express slots. I'd like to have as many of them as possible. We have an MSI motherboard here somewhere, the X-Power 2 that actually has 7 PCI Express by 16 slots on it, I think. Something crazy like that. And that's an LGA 2011 socket motherboard. So you're going to have some interesting options. This may be a little bit more expensive with that CPU.
Well, let's talk about what's going on. Intel's doing a lot of I'll choose the word interesting for this, but there's a lot going on with Intel. So to pave the way for the upcoming launch of 22-nanometer Ivy Bridge processors in April 2012, Intel has notified its hardware partners of its schedule for stopping the supply or production of over 25 existing desktop CPU models, according to industry sources in Taiwan. That's PC Pro story. Intel giveth to the server room and taketh from the desktop. So the Core i5 661 and 660, Core i3 530, and then a bunch of parts most of our audience probably doesn't really care about. Pentium E5700, Celeron E3500S, all gone by this summer. Sandy Bridge loses 6 Core i7 models and 6 Core i5 models. The Pentium G960, Pentium E6600, E550, the Celeron E3300, all gone by summer 2012. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. DigiTimes is the article with a list of all the processors that are going away. And then we look at, on the server side of things, 40 processors due for release on the server sides. 7 8-core Xeons, a half dozen 6-core Xeons, 5 4-core Xeons, a single dual-core CPU. And then later on this summer, 11 Ivy Bridge H2 series CPUs, the Xeon, E3 1290V2, and then a whole bunch of really unbelievably out of control expensive server processors. What's going on? Is Intel trying to simplify the chip market for the desktop, or they just want to basically close out all the larger process and start shoving everything down onto the it's kind of funny, right? Because as you move down to the process, the chips get smaller, which means you get more yield per wafer. So are they closing down the older lines? Are they slimming down the lineup, or are they?
I think this seems maybe a little bit premature compared to previous kind of retirements of processors. But the Core i5 661 and 660 and the i3 530, those are Clarkdale parts that actually came out quite a while ago. They're not what I would call new processors, but I mean they're at least a generation and a half past. So like we've seen Sandy Bridge come and go and that type of stuff in the meantime. And we are basically at the point now where we will see Ivy Bridge in the next couple of months. So I think they're kind of preparing for that. They don't want to have Clarkdale and Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge kind of all on the market at the same time. It seems pretty reasonable to me to, it's not like they're pulling them off the shelves. They're just kind of not going to make them anymore, which I don't think falls out of line of their normal timescales. As for the server side of things, I think a lot of it might have to do with the fact that ARM is going to be making a push into the server field, and they want to make sure they have a part that will match up with every customer's possible needs. Now, I don't think they'll be able to get that super low power quite yet. We'll have to wait for like a Haswell-based design to get that. But they want to make sure that there is a SKU for everybody on the server front. They don't want to risk losing any of that kind of market share, because that's usually high profit margin stuff.
Got it. Good to know. Speaking of profit margins, Quanta. It's kind of funny. How many, would you say there are 3 or 5 major notebook manufacturers in China that basically make all the notebooks in the world?
It's not very many. Yeah, it's not very many.
It's kind of funny. Quanta Computer, which is probably the world's biggest maker of notebooks, is suing AMD for breach of contract, alleging the chip maker sold defective products, reports Bloomberg. Quanta says the AMD chips did not meet heat tolerances and were, quote, unfit for particular purposes. Essentially that they had overheating issues because the chips broke the thermal envelope they were spec'd for. Quote, Quanta has suffered significant injury to prospective revenue and profits. And, of course, they want a jury trial. They want damages. They want money. AMD says, no, it wasn't our processes. It was your stupid design.
Nice.
It's kind of funny. And the other thing is, like, AMD is aware of no other customer reports of the alleged issues with the AMD chip that Quanta used, which AMD no longer sells. In fact, Quanta has itself acknowledged to AMD that it used the identical chip in large volumes in a different computer platform that it manufactured for NEC without such issues. Quanta, by the way, also makes Hewlett-Packard notebooks, Dell notebooks, Acer notebooks. It's kind of funny. This is one of the things where I can't decide if it's like an actual bad part or just Quanta's pissed and trying to get some money back anywhere they can on a bad run of notebooks.
It smells a little bit like the NVIDIA issue that they had, but the difference here was that there was verifiable problems with the NVIDIA chips in notebooks, and I have not heard of any of these same types of problems with the AMD chips yet. Maybe that will come to pass based on these kind of allegations, and people, you know, and Quanta wanted to make sure that its side of the story is actually told. But I have not heard from any other kind of vendor that there would be any issue with any of their parts. So, yeah, It'll be curious because Quanta is a huge company. Obviously, the chances of AMD getting a lot of design wins with Quanta in the immediate future are down.
What is the number of actually, I'm not even going to say a word about this one. Talk about the possibility of what's coming from AMD.
It's a possibility. The 7970, the new GPU that AMD released, the 7970 is called Tahiti is the code name of the GPU, and it has 2048 stream processors. So essentially 2048 SPs in there, which works out to 32 compute units, which is kind of this modular little part of a processor, part of a GPU that AMD's built, and there are 32 of them at 64 stream processors each. Multiply those, you get 2048. Well, some documents leaked out from Sapphire, actually, that indicate two things. One, while the reference clock speed of the 7970s that we have reviewed so far are 925 megahertz, these design documents list specific models with clock speeds as high as 1335 megahertz, which is a huge jump. We're talking 35-40% performance increases that you will actually see from these clock speed increases. That would be pretty impressive if they're able to scale the GPU to that type of speed. The next, and I think more, I don't know if I'd say unlikely, but kind of interesting topic is if you scroll down a little bit more, there's another product listed that actually has 2,304 stream processors. So that actually, the math works out, that's 36 compute units instead of 32 compute units. But Here's what's curious. Usually when we get a new chip, either from Intel or AMD or NVIDIA or whoever, we get a die shot with it, which is just a picture of the die, and you can kind of, maybe they'll outline, here's where the 32 compute units are and that kind of stuff. And this time we only got a diagram. We never got the die shot. And actually before the review, when I was specifically asking for this device and they would not, or this picture, they wouldn't give us one, it began to have these ideas like, well, maybe the chip has more computing power on there that they haven't enabled, like GPU manufacturers and CPU manufacturers tend to do. I was assured many times by AMD that that was not the case. And in fact, through a third party, I will say, that has been able to look at one of these parts, can verify that the chip on the 7970s that reviewers were sent, at the very least, did in fact only have 32 compute units and 2,084 shaders, whatever it was, 2048. So that means one of two things. Either this document is completely erroneous, which I do not think that is the case, because it's it's in a huge collection of documents that all seem very valid. Or AMD either had or has a larger chip, larger GPU ready that's running, a healthy percentage of stream processors in excess of what we have today. And they either had it or have it, which means they had it, the yields were poor, the heat was too high or something like that, and they ended up canceling that whole project. They said, you know what, we're just going to release Tahiti as our high-end part now, because the super high-end part that we were going to make, whatever it was going to be called, is not feasible with the 28 nanometer process we have now. Or that they have it, meaning that they were able to keep it secret up until this point, that they're waiting to release this part as something else when NVIDIA finally gets around to releasing its next generation of GPUs. And so they have some kind of answer to take back the single GPU performance crown. It's really interesting. It's also possible, I think that's less likely, that it's somehow a 18-month-old document or something like that that just was never updated and was incorrect from the get-go. Because there's a lot of specifications in these documents, and there's other pages that we don't even show in the news post at PCPer.com that gives you build outs and that kind of stuff. So I think it's pretty likely that this chip either existed at one point and they gave up on it, or it does still exist and now they're really pissed off that everybody knows about it. So it's good news. We were kind of worried that GPUs were kind of at this level where they weren't going to increase in performance on a regular basis, because the GTX 580 had been the fastest single GPU for more than a year, like 13 or 14 months, until the 7970 reviews came out a couple weeks ago. And it looks like AMD has changed that, and then hopefully NVIDIA will release something and go higher, and then AMD will release something and go higher as well, all along hoping prices come down. So Interesting rumors to talk about and discuss.
We need to wait for the 4K monitors to actually show up.
Will take that too.
Powerline Ethernet is not dead.
Good.
It's just lurking in the darkness. Guru3D.com did a pretty good roundup. If you are looking for something that is faster than Wi-Fi, maybe has minimizes the connectivity issues, but you're not willing to wire your house with gigabit Ethernet. I mean, let me say it flat out. I hardwired a gigabit Ethernet everything I can in my house because it works better, period. It just leaks.
Sure.
But it works. Wi-Fi can be an issue, especially in apartment buildings and stuff like that, where you can't really pull cable, and maybe you've got, you know, six neighbors, one on each side of you, or, you know, 12 if you're really packed in there, where their Wi-Fi routers are overlapping. 500 megabit per second home plug Ethernet review. And what the Guru 3D guys found out is that A, it works. B, it delivers nowhere near 500 megabits per second. And C, there are a couple of big issues depending on how the electrical system is laid out in your house. And I'm going to tell you to go to guru3d.com and read Sitecom 500 megabits per second home plug Ethernet review. There's a bunch of stuff it's really good for, especially if you don't want to deal with Wi-Fi. And there's some, but if you actually need like 62 megabytes per second, you're not going to get it. At least in their testing scenario, that's pretty consistent with what I've heard from other places and some friends of mine that are running it. But it does have a lot of potential. Guru3D.com has a pretty good write-up on that.
I'm a big fan of Powerline networking, although that has been my experience and every person I know's experience is that you'd never get anywhere close to the rated speeds. I'm in a pretty new house. It was built in 2005. And one of the things you get is always, well, if you have older wiring and there's more hubs and stuff like that in the way of power and that kind of stuff, that it will cause issues. I've never been able to get close to the rated speeds, but it's not fast, but it's reliable. And that's what I use it to connect my game consoles to my network, because my game consoles are way downstairs in a corner and my router's way upstairs in the other corner. And having, you know, connectivity issues is definitely a problem there. But I hook it up to power. I think my Slingbox actually is hooked up to Powerline networking as well, because I don't need huge bandwidth, but I would love reliable bandwidth.
Reliable bandwidth would be good. Would be very, very good. Kind of interesting, of all the places, VentureBeat. I got some friends work over there. I love VentureBeat, but it's not normally where I go for hardware news. But Broadcom has announced its first 5G Wi-Fi chips. And you're probably sitting there going, 5G Wi-Fi, WTF, which is a really good reaction, because since we all know 4G is eventually is really kind of invented. 4G as it's currently used in the United States is essentially an invented concept, and most of what people are calling 4G isn't exactly 4G. These are actually Wi-Fi chips that are based on 802.11ac.
Yep.
Which is basically the fifth generation of Wi-Fi standards. And pardon me while I drop my microphone and pick it back up again. We're probably going to be hearing a ginormous amount about this I'm trying to pull up, because the thing I forgot to look up before we started was whether or not this spec had actually been finalized. We should be hearing a lot about 802.11ac.
I don't think so. They call it an engineering protocol in the story.
Oh, that's a mess.
It'll be in all over again.
Yeah.
Hopefully a little bit more constricted in time spans, but... Yeah, I mean, that it's says it operates at the same 5 gigahertz band of the radio spectrum as its predecessors, 802.11a and N. Do they say in here if that affects, will that improve range as well as performance? Because the idea of operating at 1.3 gigabits per second,
right,
is great. I mean, you're talking about gigabit networking, one of the things that you just talked about wiring specifically for, and that, you know, we're going to build a new office space, and we're going to specifically wire gigabit Ethernet all over the place. Right. And I would love to be able to get that on wireless if it were an option.
I'm now looking at the IEEE 802.11 official timelines. Let me cut and paste that into the Google Doc. If you want to see something that will basically make you twitch, pun intended. Hold on 1 second. Chat, I don't know if you can see that in there now. But... it's really funny. It's like the schedule of everything. 802.11 AI, AH, AE, AF, a bunch of specs I've never even heard of. But it looks like they are still voting apparently there's a November 11th vote, possibly, for the 802.11 AC.
Bureaucracy at its best. Somebody just makes stuff faster is what I say.
Yeah, well, the problem is if you have two companies that decide, screw it, we're going to make stuff faster, you end up with the 56K, kind of the 56K modem debacle, which was later on, yes, the 802.11n. And the problem is that if you release a bunch of, you know, what happened with 802.11n, the way it was explained to me, is there is one company that had their idea and another company that had a different idea and basically used to stuff the 802.11n meetings with a bunch of people to vote. And kept the conflict alive much, 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 much longer than it ever should have been. And therefore made 802.11 acceptance in the consumer market take forever. Kind of like HD-DVD versus Blu-ray, except in the HD-DVD versus Blu-ray, finally Sony just started cutting gigantic checks to freeze HD-DVD out of the market. Speaking of freezing, there's something pretty cool... The building's Windows 8 block. Technically, this is software and we're the computer hardware show, but hey, man, that pile of hardware in your living room is useless without an operating system. And for those who are not running Linux, Windows is probably what we're running. It's pretty interesting. Sorry, was that entirely babbling?
It sounds like you've said that before, is all I was going to
do. Sorry.
This is a rehearsed piece of speech.
A boilerplate, as they say. blogs at msndn.com. Buildings Windows 8. The Buildings Windows 8 blog has an entire article on the refresh and reset your PC options. And it's pretty interesting. I love the opening paragraph. Many consumer electronic devices these days provide a way for customers to get back to some predefined good state. This ranges from the hardware reset button on the back of a wireless network router to the software reset option on a smartphone. We've built two new features in Windows 8 that can help you get your PCs back to a good state when they're not working their best, or back to the factory state when you're about to give them to someone else or decommission them. So it's kind of funny. They've reset your PC, which removes, all personal data, apps, and settings from the PC and reinstalls Windows. Or refresh your PC, which keeps all your personal data, your Metro apps, your important settings from the PC and reinstalls Windows. And part of me is like, gosh, why didn't they do this like 5 years ago?
Right. Well, so, sounds to me like they're very specific in that they say it puts your data settings and your Metro style apps. So it's not able to preserve existing applications, which would kind of be the problem, right? So it's not like if you have Photoshop installed, it's going to be able to move that installation off to the side, reinstall Windows, move that installation back without, you having to reinstall it. But it's the right step, right? So it says basically that you boot into this special mode, scans your hard drive, and your data settings and apps, puts them to the side on the same hard drive. You don't have to have an external or separate hard drive. It installs a fresh copy of Windows, and then it restores those that data, your settings, the apps that it had set aside, into the newly installed copy of Windows, and then it restarts into the refreshed copy of Windows.
A refreshed, rejuvenated copy of Windows.
It sounds like a great idea.
If it works.
If it works, always with that context. But it's one of the things that, because Microsoft is such a large software environment, they can't just, and they have not, and they probably will not ever, just cut off support for all of their other legacy software. If they cut off support for old software, we'd all raise hell, but they'd be able to make this feature, I think, more usable and more reliable and that kind of stuff, because they'd be able to say, here's how you have to write software now in order to support this feature, and if your software doesn't support it, then you don't get whatever certification you might need to get or that kind of thing. So I don't know. I think it's a good first step, but there will always be, you look at stuff like Handbrake. That's one of the applications that I use the most. Right. Will they ever support this type of technology and feature? Probably not, that type of thing. So you know,
running Linux in a couple of years, man.
Yeah.
Have Apple and Windows lock down the computing environment.
Yeah, I don't really want that either. Such is life.
Well, you want to talk about USB 3.0 four port hubs?
I would love, we could definitely do that. Real World Labs looked at
not
an answer.
Not one of my more elegant segues, I'd like to point out.
I know, it was fantastic. they actually did a review of a couple of 4-port USB 3 hubs. This is interesting timing because I actually just got a Kingston USB 3.0 memory card reader and was able to copy, you know, video from a DSLR of about a two gigabyte file at about 90 megabytes per second. So, as Ken brings this to me here, you can see this. I mean, this is the USB 3.0 memory card reader. Looks just like any other memory card reader, and being able to run at 85 to 90 megabytes per second read speeds off of a compact flash card. Obviously, your flash memory has
substituted the normal flash card reader that Ryan Shrout uses with this superior USB 3.0 flash card reader. Let's see if he notices the difference.
Oh, I did. Sorry. Like, it's like 10 times as fast as we had been previously transferring data through like
the cell phone and my iPad to have USB 3.0.
I would agree with that as well. Good luck with that iPad thing.
don't make me weep.
So the USB, I guess they're USB 3.04, well, one from Saiba, I guess I'll pronounce it. So if I just go ahead here and look at their benchmark results, they're basically seeing if does one perform better than the other. And the answer is yes, although this is one of those review websites that has the graphs that are not spectacular in terms of their scale. The difference between... you're talking about 260 megabytes to 249 megabytes per second maximized out. So while the graphs look very different on the Atto and Ada 64 results, they're not that dramatically different, which is kind of what you expect, right? You know, most of the time, if you look at USB hubs and accessories, they're going to perform about the same in 2.0, especially now. In 3.0, it looks like we're kind of getting to that level already. Which is good, you know. You don't have to worry about necessarily which one you're going to get is better than the other. Although, if you're a hardware vendor, maybe not so much. So yeah, not much different in the performance there. USB 3 is one of my favorite things. Anything USB 3 that comes out that can replace an item that I already have, I will buy it. Pretty much, drop of the hat.
There you have it.
So yeah, what was that at? That was Real World Labs. rwlabs.com, as they did a write-up of a couple of those.
I like the picture of the two USB 3.0 hubs together. I don't know if you... It's just
over
like,
the top?
It's like my new favorite hardware picture in a really long time, where it's like a circle and a square.
Oh, the box design? Yeah. So what is this about a controllable... power supply. What exactly is a controllable power supply?
Cooler Master's fully controllable Silent Pro hybrid 850 watt PSU. okay, so it uses a single 12 volt rail. It's becoming pretty common for high wattage PSUs, says Jeremy over at PCPro.com. And over at Guru3D, I want to say. Jeremy's a PCPro at Hilbert Hagedorn, which is a difficult name to say with braces, is over at Guru3D. But it's pretty crazy. So if you scroll down, it essentially has a giant control panel.
So it fits in a 5.25-inch bay, it looks like?
Mm-hmm. It's so odd to look at it, right? Because the idea is that, you know, so it's 80-plus certification, and then you get to... basically, what fits in a, if you go to the second page, they've got pictures, and they've got a really beautiful aluminum frame, a nice fan finish, and a fits into a 5.25-inch drive bay. It's a power supply unit, fan control knob, fanless manual mode switch. You can turn the, basically, so you can have a fan when you want it, turn the fan off when you don't want it, and it also has a system fan control knob and an LED indicator to let you know when you have starved your power supply from air by turning it off manually.
Don't do that.
No, that would be bad. But, you know, it's like, depending on where you're shopping, like $140 to $200. And it's, where is it? 80 plus 90%. They're claiming 90% efficiency at 50% load. Looks like a nice drive. I just thought it was really interesting that they're actually building in the ability to sort of manually shut off and try to make it as pretty as possible.
Mm-hmm.
when they pointed their dB meter at it, they were looking at something pretty light. So they do 75 centimeters away from the product. And if I'm reading that correctly, it's like 31 dB, which is extremely, extremely low. That's super quiet, especially when you take a look at the rig. If you look at page 227 of the article, you can see the rig they're testing on where everything's super exposed.
I like that the little controller faceplate that they have there not only controls the fan of the power supply, but it'll let you hook up to three system fans as well.
It's a pretty clever system. They seem to be efficiency-wise in the EU with 230 volts power supply delivered as promised. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say it's going to work fine on the 120-volt stuff here. So it is an interesting idea. 80-plus gold efficiency, 150 to 200 bucks, depending where you're shopping. And if you're nervous about the idea of a fanless power supply, or you want to be able to boost things up in the summer months or when you've got the heat blaring in the house, that is a possibility.
That's true. It's good
for you to consider. So I know a lot of people that are super nervous about fanless power supplies. So we're going to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors. If you haven't seen it, HP's got some new gaming machines come out, the Phoenix gaming stuff, and some interesting monitors coming out there. Lenovo and unveiled a ThinkPad Ultrabook, an ARM-powered laptop also. Is the Ultrabook the ARM-powered laptop?
They're two separate ones, yeah. So in the Lenovo system that has a dual-core ARM system in it basically runs kind of like an instant boot OS, essentially. It allows you to do simple things like email and that kind of stuff, email, browsing, web, listening to music, that kind of thing, with longer battery life. It's not really, kind of running at the same time as the x86 processor. It's not running Windows, that kind of thing. So it's not as super exciting as the title and naming scheme might lend you to believe. But the Ultrabook there that they have designed is $850, which is pretty nice. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to get my hands on that at CES and kind of play around with that and see if that's, we're still trying to see if we can match that MacBook Air mentality of design and that kind of stuff while maintaining Windows. And also keep in mind that the ARM-based one starts at like $1,599. So it's not a low-cost option for sure. Going
to the professional. Yeah. Let's go to the enterprise market. Yeah, it's funny because Lenovo basically did some announcements before CES. HP did a bunch of announcements. It's interesting. There was also a leak of a new HP Spectra Ultrabook, which looks like it could be really, really nice. Because HP, of course, had a tough year because the entire HP hardware department was looking around going like, are we getting sold? Are we not getting sold? Are we going to be here? What's going on? Are we no longer going to be an HP company? And now they basically pointed out that, yes, we are going to keep you the incredible, because HP is one of the largest PC manufacturers in the world. Losing that would make it more difficult to buy parts in bulk for other HP divisions. But they also announced the Phoenix gaming PC, which people seem to be pretty happy with. But it was interesting to see, we talked last week about Microsoft, or week before last, before the new year, we talked about, Microsoft walked away from CES. And a lot of companies that don't want to get caught up in the noise at CES releasing products, announcing products the week before. So I think it also, judging also.
Everybody wants to get their stuff in a little bit earlier and a little bit earlier, right?
Yeah. Well, CES is going to be unhinged in terms of product announcement. So this just seems
it's going to be a huge year. Let's lay a, yeah, exactly. Let's not forget to thank our sponsor here today before we get into our emails, Netflix. Netflix, of course, is that company that lets you stream thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, saving you time, money, and the hassle of having to go anywhere else to drop off videos or pick up DVDs. There's a lot of cool stuff here about Netflix, right? So you can watch it on basically not any device, but tons of devices. If you have a console, you can watch it on a 360, on a PlayStation 3, on a Nintendo Wii. Obviously, of course, on your iPad, your Mac, your iPhone, lots of Android phones. Those also support Netflix. There's Roku boxes, the Apple TV. If you don't have a console, you don't want to necessarily be in front of your computer or have a home theater PC when you want to watch Netflix. There's all kinds of devices that support it. My wife and I actually got a Blu-ray player for Christmas, one of those really low-cost ones. It supports Netflix as well. So there's absolutely tons of devices that you can that you can use to watch Netflix. And one of the cool features about that is you have the ability to start watching a movie in one place, finish it in anywhere else where you have access to Netflix. So you could be watching Netflix on through your Blu-ray player or through your Roku box in your bedroom before you go to bed. But you get up in the morning, you didn't get to finish that last episode of whatever TV series you're watching, and get on the bus to go to work. You can finish it on your phone, which is actually really, really cool. It adds a lot of capability and flexibility to the service. Also, if you have kids or you just like to watch things a lot, you'll be glad to know that there's no limit on the number of times you can watch any of the streaming material, right? So you can watch that same movie over and over again, or have your kids watch that episode of their cartoons over and over and over again. Patrick, you don't have any problems with that, do you?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I am a big fan of Netflix, simply because my wife can watch Bones 32 times, or my son can watch Phineas and Ferb without me looking at the bill at the end of the month and going, oh, my goodness, because there is, you know, it's flat rate. It's cheap. It is cheap, especially when you look at the cost of certain other services that are a la carte and charge you every time you roll the episode of Phineas and Ferb. Netflix, people, save your money, save your life, or at least save your pocketbook.
Indeed. And you know, you get 30 days to try this out completely free. If you're not happy with it, you can cancel it any time, right? But I don't think that's going to be the issue. You can try Netflix for 30 days completely free. Netflix.com/twit is the URL you should go to get that deal. 30 days free, Netflix.com/twit. If you use that URL, it helps us out, helps everybody in the Twit network out. We really appreciate it. And we want to thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware, and hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. We say we jump into some emails then.
Extreme Budget Gaming Card. Chad writes, greetings. I love the show, listen every week, and I find myself needing your expert guidance. First, I'd like to say that while I am a gamer, I tend to be much more tolerant than most, but not consider myself a true enthusiast. That said, I find my trusty old gaming rig in need of a new video card due to the failure of the current card. Rig's going to be 4 years old next month. But he says it plays everything I want to play. Making concessions, I do consider acceptable. 4 gigabytes of DD2, 4 gigabytes of RAM. Evision Tech, brace yourself, Ryan. This is going to hurt you. Radeon HD 3870 X2 with 1 gigabyte of RAM. It's got a gigabyte motherboard. A Phenom 9600, Genia 23 gigahertz, Antec Performance 1 P190 case with dual power supplies totaling 1200 watts. Wow. And a single Dell 24-inch LCD running at 1920 by 1200. I must replace the video card at the very least and spend an absolute most of $200, although my wife would say it needs to be $100 under. Is there any hope for my aging system? Basically, he's on a budget. He wants to keep the expenses now. And he says his rig plays the games I enjoy the most as it is now. Fallout, New Vegas, Sacred 2, Fallout 3, StarCraft 2, Borderlands, etc., etc. So just get whatever DX11 card is the deal of the day, or is there a clearly correct choice here? Thank you for your time, Chad. So.
So I have to point out, I know he doesn't want to hear this, that much of that hardware in that system is showing its age. That original Phenom processor is kind of long in the tooth. But if he's able to play the games he can play now and he's happy with it, the 3870 X2, I was trying to find some kind of reference for performance there, but I don't think I'm going to be able to find one like really handy that kind of compares with. 3870 X2 is actually a dual GPU card, but it's a dual 3-4 generation back card at this point, right? So I think if his budget is under $200, I am thinking that the Radeon 6870 might be his best option. I'm going to go by his budget, not his wife's budget, since he was the one who actually emailed in. If she wants to email in and say that he's only allowed to spend $100, we'll modify our suggestion.
Careful what you ask for.
Yeah, I know. So you can get a 6870 with 1 gig of memory, actually, for like $150, $160 before rebates, $140 after rebates. So I think that's a good happy medium, actually, between the $100 mark of his wife and the $200 mark that he is striving to stay under. And what I think is important here is that you can spend more money, but because of the, let's say, kind of the restrictions of the other hardware in his system, I don't think it would make sense. Like, I wouldn't spend $500 on the 7970 when it becomes available on January 9th. Right. I wouldn't spend $450 on a GTX 580 or something like that. So I think his price range actually fits kind of where his system level performance is at. Mm-hmm. And unless he plans on upgrading his entire system sometime relatively soon, then I think the 6870 would be a good card for that.
I think I'm completely in line with you. Sort of at this point, his CPU is going to be the bottleneck on performance. Is there a faster CPU he can drop in into the slot, or is that particular socket
on that motherboard? Let's see. He might be able to drop in a faster processor. The problem is going to be on that board. He needs to go to the Gigabyte website and figure out how, where the BIOS support for that board takes it in terms of actual CPU support. So, depending on how often he's been updating his BIOS, he may already have that kind of information. Looks like here, real quick, I can open up the CPU support list. So that will support, apparently, according to. There's a couple of revisions of the board. One that's socket AM2+, one that's socket AM3. I want to say, okay, AM2+, it should be able to support up to the Phenom 2X4 parts, which would be a pretty good drop-in upgrade as well. And you could probably find those for under $200 as well. So if he wants to spend a grand total of $350 to $400, mm-hmm. he could get a pretty good upgrade all around, I think.
There you go.
So, all right. We got an email here from Fred, who is apparently puzzled by SSD CPU utilization. Let's see if we can help him out. Patrick and Ryan, I love the show. With so many changes coming so fast, I could never find the time to keep up without your show. As the CIO of a bank, I don't have a lot of time to exercise the skills that serve me well enough to help me advance professionally. I find myself looking forward to your podcast and have listened long enough that I've come to trust your opinions. Thank you. We are considering replacing around 200 mechanical hard drives with SSDs and are beginning the process of evaluating the performance differences between current hardware configs and the resulting configuration after simply swapping out the hard drives with SSDs. To eliminate variables, the only thing we are initially changing is the physical drives, nothing else. OS, apps, etc. Just imaging the old drive to the new SSD. In this particular test, however, both drives are installed on the same HP desktop. The OS is installed on the SSD, including the page file. So I know this isn't even close to ideal to getting a real one-to-one comparison. Nevertheless, something popped up that has me puzzled. What's up with the difference in CPU utilization? Running an old-school SATA hard drive with a new Crucial M4A SSD with latest firmware. Let's see, what's he say here? All kinds of numbers I'm looking through. CPU utilization over time. The SSD is showing 16 to 17% utilization, and the hard drive is showing about 6%. So that's pretty easy to actually answer. The reason is because the SSDs are so much faster, they can handle a significantly higher amount of IOPS per second, input outputs. Essentially, they can handle a lot more operations per second. So this what designates where those operations come from, it's the processor. So the CPU has to work with more data in order to keep up with the SSD than it had to do with the standard hard drive. And if you look at his results there, and he included some benchmark results for Myometer, he's getting, in this particular configuration, almost 3,000 operations per second as opposed to 158 operations per second. So that increase in the amount of operations that the entire system has to handle is what's causing the CPU utilization increase. So... And this is kind of like a worst case scenario because Iometer is like a raw benchmark. It's a synthetic benchmark. It's pushing the hardware as fast as it can. So depending on what his specific operating system and databases or whatever he's actually doing in these systems, if he was really close to kind of pegging CPU utilization on those servers already, he may actually run into that issue when he adds SSDs in. But I still think overall performance will be better, because storage is not holding it back. So that's essentially what's happening. It's at 6% utilization, traditional hard drives are holding the system back from running any faster. Whereas when you put an SSD, you're allowing the system to run that much faster. In this case, almost three times as fast in this particular. So,
I mean, it's interesting because it's something you don't really notice on a single desktop because most of us don't really utilize most of the performances available in a Core i7. actually in a Core i3, much less a Core i7. There's been some pretty good articles worth reading on out the internet. You can check out how SSDs impact performance, eliminate bottlenecks, and keep your applications from taking off. That's up on the IO Storm. They reference the impact of SSD technology on the network and CPU, which is an article by a guy named Dennis Martin. You know, and it's really interesting because to quote the IO Storm article, common rule of thumb is if CPU utilization is low and there's a high amount of IO activity, then it's most likely a storage bottleneck. And then sort of the other question is looking at how CPU utilization is impacted by storage. But it's really interesting. It also talks about mixing your workload of random and sequential reads on the database server at the IO Storm. With the read-ahead IO for the sequential part, the CPU utilization can be fairly high, but with a low latency storage, it can still be the cause of the bottleneck for the random workload, because basically SSDs just work so radically differently and so much faster than traditional hard drives. Stuff gets weird. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just a radically different playing field. So you're going to be doing some different things and how you balance the load on the CPU because of storage change. It'd be interesting to get Alan to talk about this, because I'm sure he's run into some really curious some really curious sort of variations on this in his job. Preston's got an interesting email. It's a pretty simple question. Crossfire 5770 or a faster single GPU for a budget build? He writes in, Ryan and Patrick, I need some of your GPU wisdom. I'm looking at upgrading my friend's gaming rig in the spring on a tight budget. It's tight budget week here at Twitch. I'll be bumping it from an AMD X2 Core i5 upgraded as 9800 GT to an HD 5770 that I had laying around to play Skyrim. When we do the CPU motherboard upgrade in the spring, we'll be better off going with a second HD 5770 in Crossfire, or spend someplace else and go with a faster single GPU. We're going to try to keep the budget around $400. I have priced out CPU, MOBO, RAM, and a second HD 5770 to $410. Any thoughts? Thanks in advance, Preston.
I need to know how much a 5770 costs today. Let me go look, because it's $100.
Yeah. Whoa.
There's only two for sale on Newegg, actually. One is 115, one is 120. And I think that's pretty expensive for a 5770, to be completely honest with you, because a 6870 is going to be the 6870, like the one we just talked about, mm-hmm. that's going to be $160, right, is going to perform much better than the 5770s, in my opinion. And you don't have to worry about any of the multi-GPU kind of quirks that may or may not pop up. But that would obviously take him over his budget if he's trying to stay under the 400. I guess the issue is, I don't think I can find a card for about the same price, $100 to $115, that's going to be faster than adding a second 5770. But for $50 more, I think like the 6870, you might be able to find a 6950. Or maybe even a GTX 560 or something like that. That is going to be a much, much faster, kind of simpler, automatic solution compared to 5770 Crossfires. Yeah, the 560 Ti is going to be outside that range. We're looking at $210 to $225. So yeah, I would, in this case, I would, depending on how tight that budget actually is, a second 5770 will definitely improve performance. It will improve performance. Crossfire scales very well nowadays. But I would find it hard in today's market to want to spend $115 on a 5770 that is kind of, you know, a little bit past its, more than a little bit past its prime, right? And you can get more modern cards like the 6870 or the 560, for close to the same price, and you'll have better performance and then the ability to scale in another 6 months if you want to add another one of those cards too. That's what I would think.
There you have it. I think we're probably going to we're going to wrap this episode of Twitch right there. Twitch at twitch.tv is your email address. You want to send us the email questions, or you can tweet at us at Patrick Norton or at Ryan Shrout. If you're wondering why we're keeping it kind of trim this week, it's because we both have to Hall Patuti to Las Vegas for CES fairly early. Anything in particular? Obviously, the NVIDIA keynote on Monday is going to be a big deal, and the Intel keynote will both be standing in line early for those. Anything else you're particularly excited about this week at CES, Ryan?
Those 4.5 hours of sleep I get every night.
And what's it's not because you're out late partying. It's because you're out late filing articles. Actually, in late filing articles.
In late, yeah. You know, we have a ton of meetings, and I believe there's going to be more to the CES than maybe a lot of people are expecting. There's going to be a lot of phones. We've already seen the leaks for the Sprint Galaxy Nexus and that type of stuff. There's going to be a lot of that kind of technology if you're into that as well. But I think from a hardware side of things, there's not going to be any processor releases. There's not going to be any big GPU releases. You can get those out of your head. The 7970 will actually be for sale, apparently, as of CES as well. But there's not going to be huge component releases, but we should see some cool, interesting things. I'm hoping to see 4K displays that people are going to promise me are going to be under, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 in the next 12 months. I'm not really going to bet on it, but that's what I'm hoping.
I think it's going to be like the early years of HDTV where there's a lot of soaring eagle videos that look spectacularly realistic, and nobody will talk about pricing or delivery dates.
Yeah. But I'm more specific than you are.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we're doing like 10 short videos a day at vision3.com/CES. We're doing a live show Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And I'm driving the van load of equipment down. So if you think you see a gigantic 3/4 ton pickup truck towing a U-Haul trailer with me driving it, it was me. Say hi. Just don't walk up with your hands in your pocket if it's a truck stop at 2 a.m. and I'm looking haggard after a week at CES.
Are you driving by yourself? Nobody's coming with you?
Nobody's brave enough to drive 9 hours to Las Vegas with me.
Smart people.
Plus, quite frankly, it's just I get to listen to whatever music I want and turn the volume up all the way. I think it just works out better. That is it for this week of Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
See you next week on Twitch.
I don't know if you can hear all the sounds behind me, but that's all CES preparation.
You know what's ironic is the only thing I hear is Liz.
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
But he said that with love.
You keep saying, absolutely, tons of love. Nothing but it.
See, look at all these. It's hard to tell, but there's a lot of people here. Because now all you can see is the empty.
Hi, Burke.
So. Yeah, Burke's over there. We got Tony. We got Liz. We got Lynn. We got Alex.
Who's driving the van? Who's driving your van?
Liz and Burke.
Oh,
Burke
my.
And Liz.
Oh, my.
Just anything.
Don't get on the same road as them, Patrick.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's only really, it's we're doomed, Brian. But I have a bigger truck with better tires.